This is an interview with Vince DiBucci for the Youngstown State University Westlake Terrace Oral History Project by Joe Drobny on October 15th, 1985 at 745 Anawan Lane in Youngstown at approximately 10 o'clock in the morning. Mr. DiBucci, just to get started, could you tell me a little bit about your early life in Youngstown? For example, when were you born? Where did you originally live in this area? Things about your early family.
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, on Hine Street, on February the 28th, 1915. Then we ended up moving on the South Side, and I attended South High School, and I graduated South High in 1934. Then that was almost at the height of the Depression, and did a lot of odd jobs here and there, helped my dad because he was a stonemason, and then eventually I got initiated as an apprentice to the apprenticeship program the local bricklayers union, and from there on it was all bricklaying and general construction.
Yeah, Mr. DiBucci, yeah. You mentioned that you were born in 1915, and then you moved to the South Side. Approximately when did you move to the South Side?
1927.
What exactly do you remember as far as Youngstown, for example, in the late 20s, early 30s?
Yeah.
What was it like, say, when you went downtown into the city? How would you compare Youngstown then in the late 20s and 30s with, say, if you went downtown now?
Okay, I'm going to hate to say, but when we used to go downtown on Saturday, that was the big day. Everybody went downtown shopping for groceries and tried to meet a girlfriend and things of that sort. And the sidewalks were so crowded with people that you were not able to walk unless you pushed somebody aside. But today it's all boarded up, which I'm sorry to say, and a little risky down there to walk alone, and just it isn't like it used to be. Then we used to cross South Avenue Bridge, and there was the Republic Steel Mills, the Bessemer, and the Spike Factory, and the Rolling Mills, smoke all over the place, and the ladies used to hang clothes outside. In those days, they didn't have washers and dryers. They went with a scrubbing board. And they used to hang their clothes outside, and they used to complain on account of the soot from the mill. But with that soot, there was plenty of money around, and it was real easy to get a job in Youngstown, and a good paying job.
You would say, in about the early 30s or so, when do you think people around you started noticing the Depression as far as jobs drying up
moving industry moving out of the city?
Or I'm talking about during the 30s, did mills start to shut down?
No. In the 30s, 31, 32, and 33, the mills were shut down, but they were still there. They weren't dismantled. And when President Roosevelt got elected, he started having a lot of government programs in which called for steel to make, products out of steel, like steam shovels and shovels and bulldozers and that, and automobiles start to move. And the automobile then had more steel in it than it does today. Then the plastic did not exist. See, and that's why steel, and then at one time we made the best iron in the world in Youngstown. Quality-wise.
Speaking of that automobile there, you mentioned Mr. DiBucci, did your family have a car?
Yes, we had a car. And the gauge of the steel was a lot thicker than the gauge of today's automobiles. And everything was steel. Dashboard was steel, the roof, the whole body of the car was steel, no plastic. So therefore there was a bigger demand for the steel.
Is that generally like the family car? Was that generally the way you got around, like when you came downtown on the Saturdays?
We walked. No, we used to ride a bus. It used to cost us 8 cents for bus fare, each way, 8 cents each way. And then when we went to school, they had special coupons they had for the students, 3 cents a piece. to go to school on the bus.
Was this this Saturday going downtown, was this kind of just a big family outing?
Everybody, all the kids went downtown. They meet their girlfriends and this and that, stuff like that.
Go to the movies?
Yeah, 10 cents you got.
Okay, you mentioned briefly that you had gone and graduated from South High School.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about, you remember about going to school, about South High School itself? I mean,
yeah.
Did you like school? Did you feel about...
My favorite subject was math, mathematics, trigonometry. That's where my... And then English and history. And then in those days, it was tough. We had to study. And there was no let up by the teachers. And the women teachers in those days were not married. And they were more stricter than they are, I think, today's teachers.
Now, you mentioned briefly, Mr. DiBucci, about your father. He, again, what type of work did he do?
He was a stonemason and a bricklayer by trade.
Okay, now with a name like DiBucci, can I assume that it was he first generation? Had he just come over from...
First generation from Italy.
I see.
And I'm second.
So around home or the neighborhood was, say, did you mainly speak Italian or how?
Yeah, we spoke Italian and my dad spoke English pretty fluently. And then another thing that was funny about those days, we were the only one that had a telephone on the block. And when somebody called in for a neighbor, we had to go get the neighbor and bring him over to the house and answer the phone because everybody didn't have a phone in those days. They were not affordable.
Well, where you live, for example, now you say you lived on the south side beginning, yeah. What, about 1927?
Yeah.
Okay, was that mainly an Italian ethnic neighborhood?
No, it was Polish work? And Italian.
Polish
it was right by St. Stanislaus Church.
Were you raised Catholic, Mr. Gibson?
Yes, all the way.
So in other words, the whole block was ethnic Polish and Italian, and everybody was Catholic.
That's right.
So would you say that the neighborhood, all the kids in the neighborhood, it was like tight cliques, everybody knew each other?
Yeah, and everybody, was every corner had their own particular gang, you know, five, six guys, little cliques like you said.
Well, beside like from what you could remember, going downtown the big day on Saturday with the family, what are some of the other things that an Italian kid growing up in Youngstown in their late 20s and early 30s might have done for recreation? I mean, besides go to the movies, what were some of the
things? Go to the ballparks and play softball. Some played hardball. That's about it. Some of the fortunate ones had a bicycle or roller skates, but there wasn't much more.
Were you one of them fortunate ones there, Mr. DiBucci?
I had roller skates.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that, you know, you had a car and you had some roller skates. This leads me to a question about your family I probably should have asked before.
Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters were growing up in this house along with you?
Two sisters and a brother.
So you were a family of four then all together?
Yeah. I'm the last one.
Oh, so you were the youngster.
The other three are deceased.
I see. Now, let's get into that time in the early 30s. By this time, you're down on the south side. You're going to South High School. Now, your brothers and sisters, were they a little older? Obviously,
yeah,
they were little, but
they,
I mean,
were
they out on their own by this time?
Yeah, they were on their own, yeah.
What did they do, go to work, go to college?
My brother was an engineer, civil engineer. My two sisters married.
Where'd your brother go to school at there?
Philadelphia. And he stayed in Philadelphia. He remained there.
Do you happen to remember the name of the institution?
I think it was University of Pennsylvania, I'm pretty sure. And he stayed there because Philadelphia was more diversified than Youngstown, because he used to call Youngstown a one industry town, which he was right.
So he kind of wanted to get out in the world or get more of an opportunity than just work in the mill.
Gee
whiz, Mr. DiBucci, he must have either studied real hard to get a scholarship or else your father must have really had to save up money.
He worked himself, too. He helped to pay his own way, too. But then in those days, you'd go to college for about $300-$400 a year.
Yeah.
It isn't like now. You need a fortune to go through a school.
Did your brother was going off to college then while you were in high school?
Yeah. He was gone. He was on his own already. He was about 20 years older than me, I think, or something like that.
Well, was your brother as far as... he was much older than you.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, like, there in the neighborhood where you grew up on the South Side, was it unusual that a kid went off to college? Did most kids...
It was very unusual. College degree then, a high school degree then was like equivalent to a college degree of today. Very few kids graduated high school. That's no kidding.
So down on your block, if you had a high school degree, this
you were in good shape.
Yeah. And to have a college degree was extremely
unusual. You were in demand. They were looking for you. You didn't look for them.
I don't know how to phrase this, but when your brother had gone off to Philadelphia, was this highly unusual at this time for
very unusual.
You know, families on your block, close knit families?
Yeah, that's right. But see, we had some relatives in Philadelphia, and that's why he went there.
Okay, Mr. Debussy, in that time, we're still saying the late 20s up to, say, when you're still in school, 1932, 33. Is there any main events that occurred in Youngstown that really stick out in your mind? Like, for example, the arrival of the Depression, did all the mills begin to shut down and lay off at once?
Yeah, together they would shut down. But they stayed open intermittently, you know what I mean? Off and on, maybe 1 week they'd work and then maybe they'd shut down for 2 weeks. That happened all the way up to about 1934.
Yeah.
But there were people there maintaining these mills, though, during that course at one time, because they probably were expecting to light up again and produce the steel.
Now, was your father, was he independently employed?
He on his own, yes.
Okay, well, that leads me to the question, as much as you can remember, and this includes your father's work patterns, yeah, how did the Depression itself affect your family?
Well, it affected, we were fortunate. My dad had a few dollars, and he used to go out and work for the farmers in those days and trade. He used to build like smoke houses for the farmers, little ovens there. They used to build ovens in those days, a big bread, in exchange for food. Instead of loafing, that's the way they did it. They exchanged, they bartered, in other words. See, and this way, my mother used to can all the food in jars, you know, meats and everything. They used to can in jars. They didn't have freezers then. They didn't exist. They didn't, even a refrigerator didn't exist. It was an ice box, wooden ice box. See, and those conveniences did not exist in those days. And then some deals, he built some houses and where the money was involved, see. But he mixed it up a little bit. And he did some work on Meander Dam, some stonework there, and that helped him out a lot. I know I labored for him, and I never got paid.
You kind of helped as being a member of the family.
Yeah, I mixed this. Well, we sort of stuck together, you know what I mean? This way the money stayed together, you know, with us.
I'd be interested to know, since your father, it seems, was in business for himself, how did he go about, say, in the 30s? Like, did he advertise in the paper? How did he get these
word
contracts?
Word of mouth. They didn't have no advertisements in the paper, nothing like that. Telephone, we were the only ones on the block that had a telephone. No, it was word of mouth. And then the people used to walk great distances to communicate. And who had a car? Very few had a car. Went by automobile.
Yeah. So in other words, obviously your father must have gotten pretty well known as far as doing good work.
That's right.
Now you mentioned that he had worked originally on also the Meander project.
Yeah.
You recall how he got involved with that, or was this word of mouth?
Word of mouth. See, they'd look for stonemasons and bricklayers, and then they'd screen them. See, and then. Then they would select the ones they liked the best, or, you know, interview them.
Was a stonemason, did your father have to carry a lot of heavy tools around?
Yeah, a lot of chisels and everything. I still have some in the backyard.
Do you use the car for that, or you have a truck?
Streetcar. We used to go in the streetcar. But I'd carry some, he'd carry some, and make maybe two, three trips, and that's it.
So in other words, that streetcar system that I've heard about was so extensive that you could go almost any place around here.
Oh, yeah.
So he'd just have his tools and box and everything.
Oh, yeah. And we used to get a couple other kids to go ride the streetcar. They used to enjoy the ride, and they used to carry some tools to help out. See?
Just out of curiosity, how much did a streetcar ride cost?
8 cents.
8 cents.
8 cents. You go all over. And then you got to transfer for a penny to another side of town.
At home, did your father, his tools, I mean, you have a cellar or in the garage?
Cellar. In a little shandy outside. Very few garages in those days around the homes, all the homes. Because the automobile was a scarcity.
Yeah. Did your dad, did he learn his trade? Did he learn that back in the old country?
Yeah,
or?
In the old country.
So when he came over, did he already know some people that could get him to work?
Yeah.
Or did he have to start from scratch?
No. See, those people in those days, the first few that come over had it the toughest, the way I looked at it, because they're the ones that made the connections. And then they used to write back to the old country and tell their buddies that they left behind to come to Youngstown or whatever town it could have, may have been. And, oh, a lot of work here, this, and I know the all it leads to the contractors. And that's how they came here, see? And then they met their buddy here, and they didn't have to seek work too, you know, it wasn't too difficult to find the work.
Well, at that time, now, another question occurs to me. Now, your father was a stonemason. Would you say that a lot of the individual construction workers, like stonemason, bricklayers, did they seem to all be all Italian?
Or, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. Was it kind of an ethnic job?
Yeah,
that
was Italians, yeah. That was Italian.
How about some of the other trades? Was like, say, the Polish, for example, were they associated?
No, not in the building trades. They were mostly in the mills, the Polish people, the Slavish people.
So you'd say that...
And the Swedes were the carpenters.
So you'd say that Poles and Slovaks were mainly working in the mill.
Yeah.
Italians were mainly building trade, construction.
Yeah.
And the Swedes that were around, they were the
carpenters.
Because
in Sweden they used a lot of lumber, you know. See, where in Italy they used a lot of stone, you know, for construction.
Yeah, rocky terrain. I could see how that
That's how that came about.
Now,
then the Germans were, they were the machinists. They were the best machinists around town. This town was loaded with machine shops at one time, in case you don't know.
As well as the big mills.
Oh, yeah, the machine shops used to make parts for the mills, you know, rolls and things like that, so they could roll the steel. This was one of the greatest machine shops in the country.
What was the closest, now down here on the south side, I'm trying to think, what was the closest big foundry to you?
It was Youngstown Foundry. Right by United Engineer, right alongside the Market Street Bridge.
You know, I know growing up, I grew up in an area that was right next to the foundry, and I can remember, black air and black smoke. What do you remember about specifically Youngstown in the late 20s and 30s when all the mills were here? This is before the Depression closed them down. Was it a smoky town?
I told you about the ladies used to hang their clothes on the clothesline and they used to get all sooty, you know, from the soot from the mill. And the south side was the cleanest side of town, up this here way. Because the wind, on account of the winds used to blow the smoke towards the north side, and the west side had the Ohio Works. And that took care of, the smoke took care of the west side, and the name of Camel used to be East Youngstown at one time. And they changed the name to Camel on account of Jim Camel. Jim Camel was the founder of the Youngstown Sheet and Tube. And that place was loaded with smoke, more than any, and down around Center Street Bridge was all loaded with smoke. That's where Republic Steel was.
Well, from the people that you knew, like up there on the block, okay, you said it was mainly Italian and Polish,
yeah.
So you probably knew some kids whose fathers worked in the mills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Generally, did somebody that worked in the south side of Youngstown, did they mainly work in a foundry, you know, the closest foundry by them, or did they have access by streetcar to work over
they
in
had
Campbell?
Access.
How did that work?
The furthest that they got. The streetcar was a mode of transportation. Then they went into the buses, and that was another mode of transportation, because the automobile wasn't in existence. The automobile in this country, I will say, didn't come about till after World War II.
So you're saying, like in Youngstown, before the war, if you had an automobile like your family, that
was a big,
sign.
You was a doing, big shot. You were doing pretty good.
Now, well, up there on the in your neighborhood, for example, would you say this may sound a little funny, but since many Italians were doing private work,
yeah,
and maybe. When the big mills closed down, people that were doing private work might still have been working. Would you say, I don't know, were more Italians owned cars in Youngstown than maybe Poles or Slovaks? We already talked a little bit about the fact that your father was a stonemason, and it seemed that Italians were mainly involved in the building trade. So,
yeah.
So that's how they got employed, or you got employed by word of mouth.
That's
now,
it.
Did you know, did any of your Polish friends ever talk about, was there kind of a buddy system that got a guy hired in a foundry?
Like oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
Do you remember? Yeah. What you remember?
When the mills, I'll tell you about the mills. When the mills started to pick up, the old timers, you know, they were working in the mill, and when it was shut down, they all got called back, you know.
You talk about during the Depression.
Yeah.
Okay.
They all got called back. So when they start picking up, then they start hiring young blood, you know, and then the parents used to talk to their foreman, say, I got a son that's loafing, I'm about to give me a slip. They used to get a slip off the foreman. That was an automatic job, and they used to get this slip, and the kid used to go to work. See, where I could never get that slip.
Because you were Italian, or you didn't.
Not that they were discriminating. It was just a different clique, like, you know what I mean?
The family.
That's right. So, but they could never come to construction either, so it worked both ways.
I see. So although you weren't intentionally discriminating against a Polish or Slovak kid, it just worked by family.
Yeah, it's just a trend, like, you know what I mean? If you follow the trend.
Okay. Now you said you graduated, was it 34?
Yeah.
1934.
Yeah, and then in January. See, then they had two graduating classes, in the midterm in January and June.
Tell me a little bit about that. I never heard about that.
They didn't graduate once a year like they do now in June. Then they graduated in January, that's midterm. They had semesters, see? And then they graduated in June.
This is down at South High School?
Yeah, well, the whole system, the whole Youngstown system was that way.
Well, did you go to school over the summer at all?
No, we had the 2 months or 2.5 months off every summer regularly.
Yeah. When did you graduate, in winter or the summer?
January, winter.
Yeah.
Winter.
Okay, when you graduated then in 1934, you went working for your dad full time?
No, that's winter time. We didn't know. We were just off and on, off and on.
Oh, that's right. In the winter, things would probably got slow.
That's right. The weather, you know.
Yeah.
Then I went to Youngstown College, and I took an extension course in engineering. See, that's what I used to do in the winter. Instead of loafing, I used to go to down to college and take these extension courses.
So when you got out of high school, for the first few years after that, you'd work for your dad when there was good weather.
Yeah.
And then you'd come up to the college.
You'd go to school.
About how many years did you come up to the college for?
Well, 4 or 5 years.
Tell me a little bit about what you remember about the college itself.
Well, my engineering instructor was a man named Mr. Nichols. He worked for U.S. Steel and used to teach on the side. It was the small school then, you know. And all the teachers, most of the teachers were like part-time teachers, you know, it wasn't steady employment like you have today.
Did they have like night classes?
Yeah, that's what it went, night classes, sometimes afternoon and all.
About how many classes did you take?
All engineering.
Yeah.
But I don't know how many hours, I don't know how they did it. Then I took a course in bookkeeping, you know, business.
Yeah.
course, because it helped keep my dad, you know. See, when my dad in the 30s, there was no bookkeeping. No bookkeeping.
You kept your own books, huh?
That's right. All he had is a time book, they call it. He used to go buy downtown at Woolworths, 10 cents a piece. And you worked so many hours, Joe, Bill, and this and that, and they paid him off. No Social Security, no unemployment insurance, no state tax, no city tax. You paid him off in cash. What was left over, you kept, and that's it. And no income tax. That's it.
Well, how that, like your dad went out on a job, okay? Now, was he paid by the day?
By subcontract. Say the job was worth $500, I want $500. And then whatever he made, he made. And then he bought the materials and he paid his labor, his helpers.
So it was up to him, rather, he was going to bring along one helper or five?
That's right. It's all up to him.
But of course, he's still going to have to split up the money one way or another.
Yeah, but he's, the guy that does the splitting is the best part of it.
Yeah.
That's always been that way.
Well, just to quickly get back to when you were going up to the college, now, it seems to me that you mentioned before that to go to college was kind of a very rare experience.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so when you went up to the college, did were any of your friends going at the same time?
No, I had all.
It was mainly strangers that you ran into?
All strangers. Pretty tough to go to school.
Yeah. I don't suppose you can remember the tuition at all. Just, you know.
Sometimes we didn't even pay. We were broke. They let us stay in the classroom anyway.
Oh, really?
Sure, that's how tough it was. Sure. They had to have a few students in there. You know what I mean, Nick? Half of the guys weren't able to pay for it. They had the smarts to be good students, so they didn't let them stay in.
You know, now up there, I don't know if you've been next to the university now, they got you know, a lot of new buildings.
Yeah.
But of course, the original building is at what we call Jones Hall.
Yeah, that's building that stone front there.
Right.
My dad laid stone on that building.
Oh, your dad was...
He laid stone on that building. He didn't have the contract, but he worked for... Dan Parrish built that building, Parrish Brothers.
And your dad worked for them?
Yeah, and Parrish Brothers, Dan Parrish ended up being a water commissioner for the city of Youngstown. Then when things picked up, he moved out and he went to Pittsburgh because there was more work there. See, he was a pretty intelligent person, but he got hit. Everybody got hit by the Depression. Mm-hmm. And my dad laid stone on that Jones Hall.
So when that Jones Hall, is that where your classes were?
Yeah, that's all they had. That's the only building. And then they had a couple old houses around there. Some classes in the old houses there too.
So there was one old building, Jones Hall, and
yeah.
A couple houses
yeah.
around it.
Yes,
and that was the whole college.
That's right.
What'd you do? How'd you get up from the south side of college?
Walk.
Did you walk?
Well, you walk. Listen.
You walked. So you, during the winter then, you're going to college. What were some of, okay, say between 1934, okay, and the time you got involved with Westlake, can you remember some of the jobs you mentioned, for example, Meander? Can you remember some of the jobs that you worked on mm-hmm. with your father?
Well, see, I got on an apprenticeship program, and in those days, when you were, now it's different, when you were an apprentice then, you were not allowed to work for your dad. You had to go work for somebody else because they figured with your dad there's favoritism and you had to pass certain exams every 6 months and you had to stay away from your relatives.
Well, tell me about the way that system worked. Now your father, okay, he was...
But he would get somebody else's kids, see?
Yeah. Was he part of a guild or a union
it's
kind
a
of setup? So which union was he a part of there,
Mr. Bricklayer's Local Number 8.
Bricklayer's Local Number 8.
Yeah.
Where was there? You remember where their union hall was?
It used to be, I know, but I can't name the street. You know.
What side of town? That's really
downtown. It was downtown. It was I remember the Ringside Bar was downstairs, and we rented the building, the room upstairs. It's Commerce Street, and what's the name of the street that the City Hall is on? Boardman and what, Hazel?
Yeah, it's a, well, there's Boardman and...
right in back of the Fairmont Theater.
I know where
I think that's Hazel and Commerce.
So your father is a stonemason. Yeah. He was part of the bricklayers. Now, did most of the individual craftsmen, most of these individual craftsmen, like, say, the Swedes, did they have, like, a carpenter's union?
Yeah.
Okay.
They had.
So even the individual, so in other words, Youngstown was a union town, even for the individual...
The building trades, before the steel mills got unionized, the building trades always had a union. All building trades. And I remember my dad talking about they had a strike in 1920. The building trades.
Building trades.
Mm-hmm. That's how far back I could take you on that deal.
Was it a big one?
No, they strike a week or two. They get tired of working. They want to go play around or something like that. I don't know.
Well, I'd be kind of interested, like, in a mill, when you belong to a union, they give you health benefits. Well, you know all the benefits. What was the advantage for your dad or for any individual businessman building or construction to belong to the union? What was the union all about?
Protected your wages, that's all. You know, they say they establish a rate of $1 an hour, $1.25 an hour, and that's it, and that's what you work from. Then there was no hospitalization, no pension plans, no Medicare, no Medicaid, nothing like that. That's it. And the doctors, they charged according to what the traffic could bear.
So in other words, what the union basically did for the building trades around town was establish a
wage.
What was, you mentioned $1 an hour, was that the going rate? What was the going rate, say, in 1936, 1937?
$1.50 an hour.
And that'd be for a tradesman, like a stonemason or a...
carpenter, plasterman.
$1.50 an hour.
Yeah.
From what you knew of your, some of your friends whose fathers worked in the mill, what was the going rate then?
About 75 cents an hour.
75 cents an hour.
But they worked all year round, though. So
yeah.
See, the weather came into the picture in regard to, the $1.50 an hour, because they only worked about eight months a year, see?
That's an individual tradesman.
Yeah, well, yeah. The carpenters worked better. They made about $1.25 an hour.
Yeah.
Electricians made about $1.25 an hour because their work was inside, see? And the plastermen, too, same thing. And plumbers were about $1.25 an hour. They were a little lower because on account of their work being inside and not affected by the weather.
But all these people you just mentioned, plumbers, plasterers, they all had their individual
unions. That's
and
right.
They all set standard wages for them.
That's, and that, this way you were able to calculate a job, You figure the time and you estimate the amount of time, say 2 days, 16 hours, and so much an hour.
Mr. DeBussy, I just realized something. Since you're only working at, you and your dad only had that 8 months, and of course you were going up to the college in the winter. Well, how'd the family get through the winter? I mean,
you saved your money during the summer to take care of yourself for the winter. There was no unemployment insurance, no relief, no food stamps. Nothing.
So you saved.
That's right.
Okay. Now, you mentioned some of your people worked in the mill. You say they were getting about 75 cents an hour. Back in the 30s, obviously before the Depression closed down some of the mills for a while, besides that 75 cents an hour, what else did mill workers get? Was there any health insurance, or how'd that work?
Nothing, no health insurance, no. But the only thing you had, the only insurance you had was state compensation in case you got hurt on the job.
Workers' comp.
That's all. Nothing else. No hospitalization, no... when my mother died in 1938, the hospital room was $5 a day. $5 a day, that's all. She was in the hospital 10 days, and the bill came to $160.
With the physician's cost?
He took about $50 on the side. So it was better than it is today.
So in other words, you're saying that obviously yourself making $1.50 an hour, and these guys working in a mill making 75 cents an hour, you're saying they had to pay their own hospitalization?
They didn't have hospitalization. It didn't exist. That word didn't exist.
You pay, when you went to the hospital, you had to pay it right out of your pocket, or?
Right out of your pocket. And if you didn't have it, you pay a little bit at a time.
Was that common around Youngstown?
That's standard, all over the United States. That was all over.
How about things for these mule workers from what you remember about, like vacations and things like
that? Oh, no vacation. You took your day off, you didn't get paid. No, today's different.
Yeah. Okay, so you worked for your father for a while, from 1934 on. Now, you mentioned something about an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Now, explain how this worked. Did this have to go through the union?
Yeah, through the union. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the procedure to become an apprentice.
Well, you filed an application, and they gave you an examination. A lot of mathematics in the exams. I remember that real good. And then, of course, there was a little bit of favoritism because of on account of your dad already being there, you know what I mean? A little bit of nepotism, if you want to call it. And I got accepted. And when I got accepted, there was three others got accepted at the same time.
To be an apprentice bricklayer.
Yeah, and that lasted for 4 years. And every 6 months you got a raise, if you passed a test. Every 6 months they gave you a test. And if you passed it, you got a raise.
And so you were an apprentice for 4 years. Now, you mentioned you worked, who'd you work for?
Helen Murray Company on Rain Avenue, 222 West Rain Avenue. Maybe the university has that building now.
What, the time you worked for the Murray Company there, is that how you first got involved with Westlake?
Yeah, because he became one of the contractors that was involved with the Westlake Crossing.
Okay, before we get to Westlake, what, from what you remember, were some of the other projects you worked on via the Murray Company?
Oh, I worked for United Engineering. I worked for the GM McKelvey store, which was flourishing then. We built them a truck garage.
You built a garage for the McKelvey store?
Yeah, up on Wood Street.
Mm-hmm.
General Electric, he did a lot of work for Ron General Electric. United Engineering, Republic Steel, we did it as contractor, not, you know, we built a building for the Republic Steel, and we worked for Helen Murray, not for the mill, because he had the contract.
While you were working on these projects, was this the type of deal where it was from you know, first thing in the morning, sun up to sundown, or
no,
how many hours?
8 to 4:30.
Now, was this agreed on by the union also?
Oh yeah, the hours. That's Saturday, and no Saturday work. You got double time if you worked it. And the reason for the double time, nobody wanted to work on Saturday. And Sunday's the same thing, double time.
Well, because of the fact, so in other words, the union set, this is for, again, we're talking about individual tradesmen, they set a wage rate for the whole city.
And control the hours. That's right.
Yeah.
That's it, there's nothing else. No other benefits, yeah. Nothing.
But did they have a kind of a list maybe downtown whenever there was like a job open up or something?
Yes, that was common.
So they were also kind of like an employment agency in a way.
They used to send you out to different jobs.
Now, from what you remember, we've already figured out that your family, probably in comparison with a lot of people, did all right during the Depression.
We managed. We didn't have to go on relief.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, do you remember, say, some of the other individual tradesmen? Were you like an exception? Did a lot of people have to stand in line down at Union Hall every day looking for a job?
We didn't have to stand in line. We were fortunate.
Yeah.
See, my dad had some engineering training in the old country. And mathematics there is the same as over here, you know, there's no difference. And the only thing different is the fractions over there, they have metric, but it's easily, if you know one system, it's easy to jump onto the other system.
So because of your dad's reputation, because he could do a little bit more than some people, he kept working
that,
pretty well.
That way you eliminated supervision, see, an extra expense.
So it seems to me, Mr. Debussy, that because of the way these unions were set up and because of the things they did, if you were an individual, like a carpenter, an individual craftsman in Youngstown during the 30s, you were a lot better off maybe than a guy working a steel mill.
Oh yeah. Nobody wanted to work in the steel mills then. No, but this, later on, the steel mills became the better place to work.
But during the 30s, they were, nobody wanted to work.
Right there. After World War II, the mills took a hold with the unions.
Yeah.
But before World War II, the place was the outside.
Now, speaking of labor, and speaking of the mills, do you remember, you already mentioned that there was a private tradesmen strike in 1920. Do you remember during the 30s, you know, what type of labor environment was there around Youngstown? I mean, was there some problems? I know they had a big strike here, of course, at 1937.
Yeah, that's that they had a. Well, I remember that now that you mentioned it. They down Poland Avenue, they had like a war. They had the National Guard down there, the Ohio State National Guard. They were shooting at each other just like a war. And the National Guard were protecting. They were protecting the company, you know, the company's interest.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, were you ever down in that area to see any of the guardsmen?
Yeah, I seen them, and that's it, one time, and I never went back on account of the activity, see?
About how long did those problems last, that particular strike?
Oh, that lasted quite a while. My buddy's not here. He was working there. But he's in Washington today, he was involved with it, not as an organizer, because he worked for the steel company, Republic Steel, and I don't know, I can't tell you the length of the strike, but I remember though.
Did you have anybody up there in your neighborhood, any of the Polish kids, any of their fathers work down there?
Yeah, a lot of them worked there.
You remember, was that strike, that big one in 37, did you think that was mainly about wages or about hours or general
condition?
About everything.
See, before, when you went to work in the mill, the foreman used to line up all the employees, you know, maybe 10, 15 or so, and he would select the people that would work. You work, you don't work, you work, and you don't work, you know. And, of course, there was a lot of clicky-clicky there, see. And they broke that up with the union. That's the first thing the union broke up, see. And they didn't post no schedule on the wall. You know, you work 40 hours a week, 32 hours a week like they do now. Then you might have went the whole three shifts to get a turn. You had to appear on this lineup, they used to call it. And that's what they went after, and they broke it. And then there was a lot of nepotism there, you know, a lot of favoritism. And if the foreman didn't like you, you maybe got a day a week, 2 days a week, where somebody else was getting 4 and 5 days a week.
So you're saying that before the mill unions, the big unions like steelworkers got strong in Youngstown, you're saying during the 20s and 30s, it was pretty much up to the individual foreman how many hours he'd get to work
it was
per
mostly
week.
Company people, you know.
Yeah.
The company dominated.
Did they ever... any of your friends' fathers, or you recall, talk about the actual conditions? I know they didn't have too many regulations about safety or things.
No,
like that.
Safety regulations were bad. They were bad.
Did you ever know anybody got hurt in the mill? Or?
Yeah, but I just can't recall, you know, all the details of it.
So you'd say that big strike in 37 is probably a combination of wages. They're only making 75 cents an hour.
And then came the big war, you know, World War II, and everything was frozen. No wages went up, no wages went down. They froze everything. You couldn't even buy cigarettes, gasoline for your car. You couldn't buy tires. You couldn't buy a car. If you had a car, you couldn't buy the tires for it. And sugar was hard to buy. Oil, olive oil, like all, you know, salad oil, that was hard to buy. Shoes were hard to buy. Everything was rationed. They give you a ration book, you know, coupons. Is this all relevant?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is exactly what I want.
My wife would know more about the food.
When you were talking there now, you indicated then from through the late 30s, you worked for this Murray company.
Yeah, Helen Murray.
Okay, now they were They were contractors?
Yeah, big general. They were the biggest in the area.
Tell me about that. Can you remember some of the big contractors in the Youngstown area? You mentioned Murray Company.
Heller Murray. And then you had Heller Brothers.
Is Heller Murray?
Heller Murray's one. Yeah. And Heller Brothers is another one.
Okay.
Joseph Bookite and Sons.
Bookites.
Yeah, they're still in business. Okay.
And had those Bookites at the time, had they been in business a long time?
A long time. Felix Pisa and Sons.
Mm-hmm.
Mike DeBartolo.
Which DeBartolo would this be?
This would be Mr. Eddie DeBartolo's dad.
Yeah. He was a big contractor in Youngstown.
He was a big road contractor. Big road contractor. Mike DeBartolo. He paved Market Street. He paved Market Street before World War II, Andrews Avenue from Oak Street all the way out to Logan Avenue, the Barlow Company. He was all heavy, you know, roads, you know, concrete roads.
Is this how they kind of started building up their fortune there?
Wait a minute, I'll give you some more about him. Then he paved South Avenue with paving bricks, and then... Then he was awarded the garbage collecting contracts for the city of Youngstown. Then they didn't have it like a city ash. Every time a new mayor got in, you know, whoever was in with the mayor got the contract for the garbage. He happened to get it under Mayor Spagnuolo.
I see.
And then the war clobbered them too. You know, everybody went to war. And Edward DeBartolo Sr. now, which is out here on Market Street, he went to Notre Dame and he graduated as a civil engineer at Notre Dame. He was third in his class as far as grades. Very intelligent.
And he was Italian. Do you ever know him or his family or any?
Very good. A very good friend of mine, Edward Senior and Junior and Mike DeBartolo. That's the one that came from Italy, you know. Just like my dad. You know?
Did you ever do any work for the DeBartolos there when you
were? We used to do curb work, and then I help them lay bricks on South Avenue, pavement bricks. That's still there. The bricks are still there.
Did they? Did the DeBartolo company or any of these individual companies? Now you mentioned the going rate was like a certain amount.
Yeah.
Could they pay more in the going rate?
They could pay more, but not less. But they didn't pay more.
Nobody paid more.
No. You got what you had.
Was there any of these companies that some people try to stay away from as far as working? Did any company or contractor have a bad reputation in Youngstown? Mr. DeBucci, now you say you were a bricklayer, and you were working for a Murray contractor.
Yeah,
sir,
Heller Murray.
Heller Murray.
Yeah.
What exactly... did you have to take tools along on your job? I mean, were you responsible for your own tools?
Oh, yes. Yes, you bought your own tools. I think it's still the same way today.
Yeah. And when you went out on a job, were you out there along with three or four other types of workers? Like, obviously, electricians didn't come in until later.
Yeah.
But
carpenters were with the cement finishers and three or four other bricklayers, you know, they would watch us so we wouldn't make too many mistakes, you know.
Okay, now we're up to about 1938-39. By the way, you mentioned to me that your mother died.
She died in 38, yeah. And when she died, now I remember I was working at on Hilden Market where they make bedding, mattresses and everything. That was for Heller Murray Company. We were putting that building up.
Yeah, that's right on the corner of where?
Hilda and Marcus Street. Okay. That's would be the northeast corner.
Now, when your mother died, was it shortly after then that you mentioned you'd moved again from you moved from the south side?
And then we went down Smoky Hollow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was soon after.
Yeah.
Were you living down at Smoky Hollow when you first got involved with Westlake?
Yes.
Okay, let's start talking a little bit about Westlake. Do you remember, did word go around that there was a big government contract going in. When's the first time you heard about it? Were there rumors that
there were rumors, but we didn't know how big it was going to be, money wise or nothing. We didn't even know the location of the project.
Yeah.
And then all at once they bid the job, and then we knew. You know what I mean?
So. Murray Contractors, what all were they responsible for when they bid?
Here's what happened, see. That was a federal job. That was about a $3 million job. I remember the figure pretty distinctively. See, and the plumbing was separate from the $3 million was the general. I don't know what the plumbing figure was, and I don't remember what the electrical figure was, but the plumbing, they were all separate, three different separate figures, but the general was $3 million. And Morris Scheibel was the architect. Okay. Now these three contractors, Morris Scheibel was then the electrical was Carlson Electric.
Carlson Electric, yeah. The electric.
Company. Yeah.
Are they still around?
I don't know. And Scholl and Schaffen was the plumbing and heating.
Scholl and Schaffen.
They're not around. I don't think. I don't know. I can't tell you for sure. And then the builders syndicate come into action. They were the general contractor. Now let me tell you how that came about. Now these jobs all had to be bonded, and you had to have a certain amount of assets to be able to meet the bond requirement. All right.
So you couldn't have just gotten started.
No.
Contract.
So the bond requirements were so great that any one of the following three general contractors that I'm going to name weren't capable of bonding this job. So they formed what they called the Builders Syndicate. See, and this Builders Syndicate was comprised of Felix Pisa and Son Contracting Company, Joseph Buchheit and Son Contracting Company, and Heller Murray. They combined their assets in order to form the requirement to meet the bond requirement.
So you're saying that individually, Heller and Murray would never got that job?
Or Buchheit or Pisa. Okay, so they were the successful low bidders. They had a bid, and they built it under the Builder Syndicate Corporation. They formed a separate corporation, and they built under that. Now, Morris Scheibel was the architect. P.L. Straight was the housing administrator. He was like... What is it, Amadeo now?
Well, now it's Mrs. Ianazum. Well, Chester Media was.
The Chester Media, yeah. Was something like, well, okay. It was similar position. And then, okay, the jobs were bid and they started to build now.
What exactly did this builder syndicate, I mean, were they responsible for like the bricklaying? And
they
were
responsible for the excavation, the landscaping, the bricklaying, the concrete work.
How about the actual carpentry work?
Carpentry work, everything, all but the electrical and heating and ventilating. Okay.
So you were still, while you worked on a project, you got your paycheck from Heller and Murray, or did the Builder Syndicate
come out? Builder Syndicate. And Nick Tatangas was the head bookkeeper of the project, Nick Tatangas. He lived on Williamson Avenue, and he took care of all the bookkeeping just for that project because he was an experienced construction bookkeeper, and he made all the payroll checks under the builder's company.
Well, for this builder's syndicate, you mentioned the companies were in it. They would have formed about 38. They would have had to form even before any excavation was done.
Oh, yeah. It was all the paperwork of the corporation was in motion, you know what I mean? It was registered with the state of Ohio and everything, see?
Well, just to give me an idea as to say how many people were actually employed on the project, for example, how many people say that had been with Heller and Murray, like yourself? An estimate.
Yeah.
Ended up working in some way, shape, or form on that West.
Well, here's the way they worked it. They got all their key men. Each one of these contractors had key men. See, which they and they, like Heller Murray had one bricklayer foreman, two bricklayer foremans, A book guide's bricklayer form, Gary Hogue, they didn't use him there because a book guide has something else going on the side where he didn't have to be bonded, some which was under the Joseph Book Guide Company, separate corporate. Bud Thorpe and Louis Altier, they're all bricklayer foremans. And then they hired, you know, out of the hall, you know, the bricklayer. There was about 60 bricklayers on that job.
Okay, so in other
about
words...
About 9 months.
So in other words, they not only got a hold of the bricklayers and also the you know, the carpenters that were already working for like Pisa and Son and Bukai, but they also went down, you're saying, to the union hall, maybe put up notices?
Yes, and then they had a carpenter foreman, one foreman, Sam Carson, he built the basements or concrete walls. He was in charge of forming up those, the forms and pouring concrete in those walls. And then they had Lynn Osgood, another one, he was in charge of partitions and everything, and then and then John Demmel, he took care of all the roofs. He cut all the rafters for the roofs. That was his response. They broke it up into an organization, see? And everybody had their own, like, little department, see? And then they had concrete crews. They had Joe Fish was a concrete man. And I can't remember the other guy's name, but Perilla. Joe Perilla was a concrete.
You know, you're mentioning a lot of these names. It seems like that kind of... you know, mainly clique of Italians working on the trades and the bricklayers. Would it be accurate to say that most of the bricklaying and most of the bricklaying done down there on Westlake was done by Italians? Would that be
the
bricklaying?
Yes. I would say the biggest percentage of it.
So you were getting your check through the builder syndicate.
That's right.
Were you paid like every week,
two weeks? Every Friday we got paid. Every Friday. And you got paid for the actual time you worked. If it rained 1 hour on a given day, you didn't get paid for that 1 hour. You only got paid for seven. You didn't get paid for eight.
Were you still working 8 to 4:30 on his project?
Yeah, and if it rained like 1 hour, 2 hours, you were docked from your pay.
Do you remember by any chance the going rate on that project?
$1.50 an hour.
$1.50 an hour.
For the bricklayers.
For bricklayers.
And the labor's 75 cents.
The common laborer gets 75.
75 cents an hour.
How about somebody like an electrician? What were some of the other rates?
About $1.25.
$1.25 for electrician?
Yeah, plumber, $1.25, that's right.
Seems to me there, Mr. Debussy, that if you were a bricklayer, you might have been getting the most as far as
yeah, because how about when it rains? You go home.
Yeah. That's...
Where the other trades have stayed inside and worked. And all the brickwork, that's all, those buildings, the floors are all concrete. No wood. The walls are all masonry, brick and block back up. The only wood on in the partitions inside are all made out of clay tile, like a pottery, you know, just like I don't know how would I describe it. It's a terracotta clay tile, all fireproof. See, the only wood on those buildings are the rafters of the roof. And the roofs are all slate roofs. And the bricks at that time cost $15 a thousand.
Speaking of those bricks, who supplied the materials? Who were supplying the bricks? You know,
well, the bricks were, I don't know who supplied them, but I'll tell you where they were made. They were made in Bessemer, PA. And the blocks came, it's a Haydite block, it's an insulation block, it's similar to cement block, but it's an insulating and high insulating qualities. They come out of Akron.
You know, I don't know if you know the inside on this, but it seems that all local people ended up getting the contracts.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Do you know, were there any outside bidders? Or?
Oh, yes, there was a lot of bidders. Oh, yes, a lot of outside bidders.
Do you remember any? Like
no, I don't. Can't remember the name of the outside contractor, you know.
Well, was it... when the government awarded this contract, did they award it? Award it strictly on bid? Or do you think there was some behind the scenes?
I don't know about that. But the low bid, I think, was strictly bid. Low bidder got the job.
Yeah.
Now, you want me to give you a description of these three contractors?
Sure.
Heller Murray, and it does not exist anymore. And they had an estimator named George Wallstrom. Who estimated this whole job was highly efficient estimator. He even built Meander Dam. He built the dam, this Mr. Walson. And he did all the estimating and...
Well, at the time he, excuse me, but was Heller Murray then also involved in that Meander Dam?
No.
They weren't, but he was.
He was. Okay. And he had a high skill reputation as an estimator, known all over the country. And then Ben Bookite was there, Earl Bookite was there, and the existing Bookite, Pete Bookite that's running the show now, he was just probably a young kid, maybe 10, 12 years old, something like that.
So this was Pete Bookite's father?
Yeah, Pete Bookite's father and his uncle, Earl. And then with the Pisa Company, you had Bill Pisa, George Pisa, and Art Pisa, and Edward Pisa. Now, they're all dead. They're all deceased. Okay? And now, there's a picture in existence. I don't know if you can get it, but I'm going to tell you where it's at. Robert C. Pisa. He's down there with Bookite Company on Simon Road. He has a picture of the signatories of the contract with the architect there, his dad, Bill Pisa, his uncle, Art Pisa, and Benny Bookite, and George Wallstrom. So if you want a copy of it, you can get them that through calling up the Bookite Company down here on Simon Road. Okay.
Wow. So this is basically, we were talking about the builder syndicate.
Yeah, okay. Now let me give it to you some more, see? And they made their own concrete on the job. They mixed their own concrete. They had what they call a batch plant, and they delivered it to the different, you know, locations of the buildings and that.
Where did this concrete come in from?
They made it themselves. They bought the sand and the gravel and cement, and they made it themselves. And then towards Evans Field, they built a community house, but Katzman Company built that.
Their name again was what?
Katzman's. K-A-T-Z-M-A-N. Emmanuel Katzman.
This a local?
Yeah, local. That was separate contract. And while all this was going on, then they built Covington School. The builders company got the contract for Covington School. That was
the builder syndicate built Covington.
Yeah, right. That's right up there, and that's still there. And
from what you remember, did they build Covington strictly because they were putting in this
Yes,
new,
sir, because the school population in that area was going to grow on account of this rental bit that was going to occur, you know, as the buildings.
When you first got down there and began to work, now you were there for, how long did you work?
9 months.
What was down around Westlake Crossing?
All old shacks and stuff like that. They demolished them and burned them and stuff like that and cleared the whole site. See.
So there were shacks and slums
there. But that was all done prior to letting the contracts of the new construction.
Who demolished them?
Somebody else. I don't know who. It wasn't the builders company.
Yeah.
The land was bare when we went there. It was all torn down.
So you don't know if it was a local firm? Or
no, I don't know.
Okay, now, you were describing the workforce to me, and then you described the common labor that got the 75 cents.
Yeah.
Now, where did the common labor come from? Were they part of the, like, WPA or
no,
government?
No, they were no WPA, but there was a word of mouth again. See, the bricklayers say, hey, I like this guy for laboring, and the contractor, like, he likes it, and this word of mouth.
Oh, so the builder syndicate people, they decided who they'd hire as common labor.
Oh, yeah. They got together. Everybody had to see all these three different contractors. They had their own little organization. They brought them right in there with them, with you. See, and then as the job started diminished, then they picked up. Then the business started to pick up in Youngstown, and they started taking everybody to this job, that job, and that job. See,
yeah. Was this 75 cents an hour common labor? Was this union determined too?
No, they didn't have a union then.
The common labor didn't have it.
No, but that come about later.
So in other words, like the electricians and the plumbers and yourself, you were still on all the union standards working on a Westlake project.
Yeah.
But the common laborers, they were on that. Well, who established that 75 cents an hour?
Well, I don't know who established it, but I don't know. I can't tell you who established.
You don't know if it was the government or if it was the
government. Government didn't control no rates then. They didn't have all this government control then. Then when you got paid then, your only thing they took off you was 1 penny on a dollar for Social Security, 1%, and that's it. No other deduction on your paycheck. If you made $100 for the week, they just took a dollar, and you got the rest of the money.
I see. So that's all came out of the paycheck.
Yeah, and then when you hit $3,000, you know, your Social Security would stop. You know, the deduction would stop.
Now, you mentioned you worked there for 9 months and you were a bricklayer. Now, do you remember, did you just work in a particular area at that project, like down along Madison, or did you
they had the bricklaying department broken up in about three crews. I was in the foundation department. We brought everything up out of the ground, up the first floor level. Then he had two crews to pick them up from first floor level to the height of the roof, the other two crews. But we stayed. Then when we got through with all the foundations, we went inside and built all the partitions out of this terracotta 4-inch tile. And that's where, and all the frames inside were metal. I think they were made by Truscon.
Truscon
Steel on Albert Street. It used to be a subsidiary of Republic Steel. See,
again, we're talking about a local firm.
That's right. They try to keep everything local, you know, as far as buying, you know.
Do you think this was an intentional policy? I mean, did you hear this, that, you know, although bids went, it was...
Well, after you became a successful bidder, you could buy any place you wanted to.
Yeah.
You weren't controlled, you know.
So when you worked down there in the Westlake project, you covered every area from Madison over by Wirt.
And I started up by Evans Field all the way down by the colored YMCA, all the way down there, all the way down.
So you had a hand in almost all those buildings.
Yeah, and I was, and the construction superintendent of the project was Clyde Bledsoe.
Now you said they broke you up into three different crews.
Yeah.
About how many bricklayers plus common workers, you know, labor, were there in each crew?
Our crew was about 10, 12 bricklayers, about the same amount of laborers.
So about 20 guys in a crew.
Yeah.
20 guys in a crew. Okay. Can you remember, for example, now you worked there 9 months, what time of year was it when you started, and what time of year?
Spring of the year, like March. It went all the way to the...
Seems that'd be March of 39.
I went all the way to December.
Did you, now you mentioned when bad weather came, you didn't work.
Yeah, but I worked. You see, we had inside work. See, the partitions like these are made out of wood. They were made out of this terracotta. That was an exceptional job, see? And that was a soundproof building. And then I think every three buildings, or four buildings, they have a basement, and in this basement they would have like groups, you know, of four buildings. I think it was four. And in this basement they would have a schedule for when you could go down and wash your clothes. Not every building had a basement.
You mean for the residents?
Residents, that's right.
Well, as far as the weather goes and you work in there, do you remember the weather causing any big difficulties? Were there any major difficulties as far as you were concerned on the job during those 9 months?
No strikes. The weather, when it rained, it was like a normal weather year. Yeah. It was no strikes. Everybody was happy because things were tough then. And that really opened up a lot of jobs. And then a lot of people, supporting industries made money off the project and this and that, see.
Tell me a little bit about that no strikes. It seemed like most people were happy to have the work, so they didn't cause any problem.
That was the idea, because a lot of them were hurting, you know. And then if you got 7-8 months of steady work a year, you really had a good year.
So there were not really any labor problems, and you didn't really have any major difficulties as far as the weather.
And they also built that Covington School.
When, you know. Did you have a hand in that? Did you have
anything? No, but it was going up at the same time.
Yeah. So the builder syndicate had people over there at the Westlake site, and then they had people over there at the Covington school.
And at the Covington school, they had a fellow named Snyder, and he was Buckeye's general construction superintendent, and he took care of that. See, it was all broken up, and the organization was set up right. You know, they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. Speaking of difficulties, do you remember any labor accidents or anything that occurred during that?
No, I don't know. Maybe. No, I don't. I don't. Maybe something happened, and I didn't know about it. You know what I mean? But in those days, everybody minded their own business. The word of mouth didn't go. I don't know. It's not like today. It was a different story then.
When you were working, we've seen some old pictures, and it seemed like there were a lot of. I remember one time Mrs. Roosevelt was there on the site. It seemed like there were always dignitaries coming through and looking over. Did you ever notice any top brass or big politicians?
No.
Or
if they came through, they must have came through there on a Saturday or Sunday, because we didn't work Saturdays and Sundays then. We just worked 5 days. And we didn't even know about it if they came through.
So in other words, you personally don't remember seeing any...
No big shots like that.
Big shots.
No.
Before we start to wind down the interview, I did want to ask you a couple other questions about the people working and then not working during the Depression. From what you remember, you mentioned there was a type of relief system.
There was
a dole. Tell me a little bit about what you remember, even if you weren't on it.
No, they gave you a slip, see, to go get, say, $10 worth of groceries. But you had to go to work, see, with the water department, or with the Mill Creek Park. And you had to work that $10 out. They give you, they had it, I don't know what the hourly rate was, but they had a rate so much an hour, okay? Let's assume they gave you a $10 slip. I'm guessing at the amount. Maybe the labor for the city was 50 cents an hour. Okay, you had to go there and work 20 hours before you got the slip.
I see. Now, this by they gave you a slip, we talking by now the federal government or WPA?
Yeah, WPA gave you a slip so you can go to the grocery store and buy your food.
But you had to work that out.
Yeah, you had to work it out.
Doing what? What did some people?
I like you go out Mill Creek Park and plant bushes and with the water department help put new pipelines. Or see, they put in a lot of sewers then, see? A lot of these sewers were put in then. And that's where a lot of these developers capitalized on those sewers. See, a lot of raw land, and they threw in a lot of streets, you know.
So you're saying a lot of sewers were either repaired or built in some way by these government projects, people are working off their relief, so to
speak.
That's
right. You can still go buy a lot in certain areas of the area, of the community, you still have to pay for that WPA sewer.
Now, since these contractors were working in the late 30s and then got to working on Westlake, would you say that mainly it was the mill workers that ended up going on relief? Mainly?
No, it was a little everybody. It was everybody. You can't, mill workers in construction, there was no exceptions. I remember one time there was 20,000 families in Youngstown on relief.
20,000 families.
Families, yeah, not individual families.
Well, other than this time that you told me about going in the winter, obviously, when you couldn't work and you went up to the Youngstown College, you couldn't work because of the weather, was there any time there, say, from 1934 through about the time you worked in Westlake, was there ever a time during that you couldn't find work because there was simply nothing to do?
There were streaks of that. And then another thing, these people that were on relief, if you want to know about relief, is they had kids like 16 years old, 17, 18, they had to go to CC camp, Civilian Conservation Corps. That's all over the United States. They went and planted trees and everything. This conversation, you know, the Californian planted trees and this and that. They got $1 a day.
Dollar a day.
And the kids didn't get anything.
So you'd say that really, in one way or another, just about everybody that was a working man in Youngstown was affected by the Depression. Although it seems like you ended up pretty lucky compared to most.
You got hurt. Then the banks were closed. You couldn't get your money out of the bank if you had any money in the bank.
That was about 1933, I think.
Yeah, and then they used to have different agents. The banks used to have different agents in a one-room office down in one of these some local building downtown, and they used to try to buy you out for 40, 50 cents on the dollar on your passbook. Oh, there was tough fun. And they didn't have, the banks didn't have any insurance like they have today.
Yeah. How about, you mentioned that you've grown up there on the south side near a particular, what was the church?
St. Stan's.
Yeah. Was that where you went?
No, I went to Mount Carmel on some of that.
Mount Carmel. Did the churches during the Depression, I mean, did they try to take care of people?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that a little.
Oh, they had soup lines in the churches, and people used to go work there. And they helped a lot. They helped a lot. The Catholic priests, they were, that's the ones I was involved with. I don't know about the rest. They helped a lot.
With soup kitchens and supplying families down on their luck.
Bread and this and that, see. You used to buy six loaves of bread for a quarter.
Six loaves for a quarter.
Every Saturday, six. Down Olds, George Olds had a baking. It was down right by the city hall. Across the street from the city. Six loaves of bread for a quarter.
Basically, to kind of close out, I'll take you back to Westlake for just a few minutes. Now, at the time you were working on that project, you were living over there in Shady Hollow.
Yeah, Smoky Hollow.
Smoky Hollow, rather. Yeah. How'd you get to work?
Well, I bought a car, 24-foot, Model A Roadster for $25. That was a big deal then.
This was about 1939 and you drove to work.
Yeah, $25.
Well, Mr. Debussy, would you say that you were kind of special in that you were one of the few people working on that project that had a car? Or?
Well, the older people had it, but the younger ones, I was one of the few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you basically worked about 8 in the morning till 4:30?
Yeah.
And not on Saturdays or Sundays?
No, unless it was an extreme emergency. Where'd you get those pictures from Eleanor Roosevelt? I didn't know if she was there.
Yeah, she was there in 1939. They had a write-up in the newspaper there.
Yeah.
When you worked, did you work on the project at your own pace, or were there specific times when you took breaks, or how'd that
work? No breaks. You worked steady right through. No coffee breaks, nothing. No, you didn't even... No, none of that, no.
Well, now I understand that the Builder Syndicate, you know, the foreman, the bosses, they were Builder Syndicate, but did you ever notice, like, government inspectors?
There was government inspectors on the job.
What were they doing?
Well, they checked the workmanship and see that it wasn't... The architect had an inspector, his name was Fritz Knorr. He was a local man, and he was a bricklayer by trade, and the architect hired him to check that the brickwork was going okay. And then there was a federal inspector over him, checking all phases of the work.
Were you told either by the Builder Syndicate or any of these government people that you were on some type of time schedule? Did you have to do it in a hurry, or what was the...
Oh, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
No, I don't know all the details because I was too young to get, but there was time limits there. They had time limits.
Well, it said you worked on it for 9 months. Now, you mean at the end of 9 months... all of the project was up, or?
No, at the end of 1 year it was all completed.
Yeah.
It was all completed. See, and they had a continuity. Everybody followed up. The bricklayers, the cement finishers, and the roofer, and the plastermen. All the walls are plastered, by the way. There's no drywall on that job. All plastered. And everybody had a continuity, see? Then the glazer would come in and put the glass in, on those different windows and everything, see?
What I'm mainly getting at is that anybody, like your bosses from the Builder Syndicate, were they always trying to emphasize to you, you got to keep work going, we got to get things done by
all... Oh, yeah, because, hey, things were rough. They had you going.
You're under the impression maybe that was part of their contract with the government, that they'd get this work done by a...
Oh, I've had a lot of other experience with the government work. All government work has a stipulation of time, of a time limit. Just especially school work too, because they want to start using this building as soon as possible, see? And then that there went too, because they wanted to start collecting the rent.
From what you remember, now they first started putting people into that Westlake housing terrace in 1940.
Yeah.
From what you remember, how about that Covington school that the builder syndicate were working on? Was that finished also?
That was finished. That they were all on schedule. See, there things were so slow. There was a scarcity of work that all these prime people were available. See, and it was easy to organize. See, it wasn't the like after World War II, there was a construction boom, and it was difficult to get prime people, see? This here, and everybody was glad to go to work, see? And it was easy. They made money.
Well, did the Heller and Murray people, like yourself, you probably knew a lot of the fellas that were working for Buckeye.
Yeah.
In other words, it was that kind of clique. Everybody knew everybody else.
Right. It was friendly. But everybody worked hard.
But because of this kind of friendly atmosphere, you'd say cooperation was easier?
Oh, a lot of, very good. There was no dissension on the job.
Now, just to close out, now you mentioned getting this contract for the Builder Syndicate.
Yeah.
How long did the Builder Syndicate, as a syndicate, last? Did it just break up after
that? Right after when they got through with Covington School and the housing project, that was the end of the syndicate. They dissolved the corporation.
Well, for the company you worked for, Heller and Murray, did getting being a part of Westlake, what did it do for the company? Did it lead to other contracts down the road? Or?
Well, Heller and Murray went on functioning as Heller and Murray, and Joseph Buchheit went on functioning as Joseph Buchheit, and William Pisa and Sons went on functioning as William Pisa. They were located on Andrews Avenue, William Pisa. By the way, they have Felix Pisa. Felix Pisa and Sons and Company. William was one of the sons. Now there's a doctor in Youngstown, Felix Pisa. He's a surgeon, a notable surgeon. He's a grandson of the original Felix Pisa.
I see. How about some of the other companies like Carlson or Schollen and Chaffin, the plumbing and heating there, and a lot of these other, you mentioned a lot of the common workers that got hired and was this Westlake, was getting being a part of Westlake, did it lead to bigger things?
Then they start hitting bigger jobs in the mills, see. Then they start doing a lot of work in the mills. See, that what happened then, around 40, see, the war was coming about, see.
Right, okay.
And the mills start booming and everything, and they had to do a lot of construction work in the mills, build new furnaces, this and that, office buildings, and the warehouses, and a lot of these companies got a lot of that work, see.
That had been working on the Westlake.
That's right, see. The electrical, plumbing, and Buchheit, and Heller Murray, and Pisa.
Oh, so you ended, did you ever end up working?
No, I ended up in the Army for 4 years.
I see. When did, just out of curiosity, when did you go in there?
1942, February.
So it was 1942 until the end.
Until the end, until the extreme end, yeah.
And when you came back, did you get rehired with Heller Murray, or how'd that work?
I went on my own.
I see.
Because I used to do a lot of reading and studying in the Army.
So what you're basically saying is, in 1940, which is really when the Westlake Project was ending up,
yeah,
and people were starting to move in with, maybe starting to arm for what the government thought was a coming war, the mills started to pick up.
Oh, yeah.
So would you say that, from what you could see, in 1940, Youngstown was coming out of the Depression?
Oh, yeah. 38, 39, 40, that you could see daylight.
Yeah.
See, and another thing, that project, it come out smelling like a rose financially for the Metropolitan Housing Program, because they rented, they got a cheap rate, interest rate, about 2-3% on their money. They had a 60-year mortgage.
You mean the money they got from the government?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the rents went up, see? They started with a low rent then, see, and as inflation came about, the rents went up, had to go up, but the mortgage stayed the same,
right,
with that low interest rate, and that really worked out. The way I got it figured out, it worked out financially beautifully.
Just to close out then, Mr. DeBussy, is there really anything else you think you'd like to add or anything you can think of as far
like
as your involvement with the Westlake project?
That's all.
Anything else, period, that you'd like
to add? If you get a copy of that picture from Robert C. Pisa, send me a couple copies, will you please? All right?
Okay, fine. We'll see what we can do.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. I really appreciate it, Mr. DeBussy.